This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Today we have in studio some representatives of a produce subscription service that is called Imperfect Produce. Why is it called Imperfect Produce? Well, we'll find out, as well as find out about the opening ceremony for their local operation expanding around the region and now in Northwest Indiana. We have another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University for you today, and also a conversation with NDOT spokesman Scott Manning. NDOT is joining in with other organizations within the Midwest to create a new way for truck drivers to find parking spaces at the interstate rest stops rather than having to park on the shoulders of highways to take a break. That and more coming up, but first we have the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, okay, they aren't pretty. They aren't perfect. In fact, they're imperfect. In fact, that's how Imperfect Produce came up with the corporate name. It's a produce subscription service that delivers fresh, so-called ugly produce to consumers that the produce that might otherwise have just gone into the trash. Maybe perhaps to a food bank, but more than likely it would have just gone into the landfill. And we have with us in studio to talk about the operation that is expanding into Northwest Indiana as of next week, Sam Lacey, who is working in the Chicago area with the company, and with Nathan Sumner. He's the Director of Quality Control for Imperfect Produce, and they're joining us here in the studio to talk about this unique startup, how it's expanded across the country and now coming into Northwest Indiana. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Well, happy to be here. First, I'll open it up here, Sam. You can, since you work with this work with all this produce on a day-to-day basis, you're personally familiar, not but name by name, you know, with this produce, but you know about the produce. Why did Imperfect Produce take on the opportunity to find another use for produce which otherwise would have probably, like I said, ended up in the landfill?
So the idea for the company was founded by our CEO Ben Chesler when he was in college, and he noticed a lot of, you know, the really overwhelming food waste coming out of his dining hall, and really wanted to address that issue. And all through college, founded a network across the East Coast that worked with dining halls to get that food into hungry hands. Through that, he met his co-founder Ben Chesler, and they moved out west to San Francisco to found the company to continue to address that problem. And, you know, the root of that problem is supermarkets, they want everything to look the same. They want it to be the same color, same size, you know, stack neatly on a shelf. Anybody that's gardened or, you know, gotten food from a CSA, you know that it doesn't always come out that way.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, I've grown tomatoes at home for years, and I've never hardly – well, I won't say never. That would not be accurate. I hardly ever have any tomatoes that have come out that look as nice as the ones that I would buy at Meijer or any other supermarket for that matter, too. And we know that they're looking for the perfect produce, I suppose you could say. And this is just a good way to be able to show people that the imperfect produce is always out there, and it's still as good, if not tastier, perhaps, than some of what you might find on the supermarket shelves in the supermarkets these days.
Yeah, and a fair amount of our work, you know, is training the public on, hey, this stuff looks a little bit different. It might be a little big, might be a little bit small. This carrot has three legs.
Yeah, in fact, we have a few samples here in the studio on the table to look at. We have, like you just mentioned, we have a three-legged carrot. It's a beautiful carrot. It looks just as nice as any one single-legged carrot, but it happens to have three legs. And we have imperfectly formed tomatoes and looks like green peppers or peppers, red peppers, I guess, or it would be a red pepper, I guess, if it ripened more. Yeah. And other vegetables as well, too. And maybe the closest you might find is some of these rather lumpy-looking potatoes, or I guess sweet potatoes or yams, however you prefer to call them. You find all these there at the service, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of stuff will look funny, different shaped. You know, like you said, this, we've got a pepper that's half yellow, half green, and that's just sort of inconsistent ripening.
Mm-hmm.
but totally going to be, you know, tasty when you cook it. But you'll also get some stuff that looks totally fine, and that a lot of the times that is surplus produce where, you know, for an example, you know, there's a weather change and an entire field of romaine lettuce becomes ripe all at the same minute, and they can't find, you know, their normal supply channels may not be prepared for that flood of produce, and that's where they would get in touch with our supply team and let us know what they had. And so sometimes you've got stuff that's totally good that's going to waste, which is also a shame. And so you'll find that stuff in our boxes.
In fact,
as well.
That brings up the question is, where do you folks find the produce that you offer up on the service Imperfect Produce?
Yeah. So we are, our goal is to fight as much food waste as possible, you know. So we will follow the waste, which leads us to work with pretty large farms because there's a lot of waste there. But we also are working with smaller farms in the Midwest, Michigan, Indiana, you know, just recently our supply team reached out about a grower in Michigan who had a couple hundred thousand pounds of wasted asparagus last year.
Oh my goodness!
Purely based on the length of the asparagus, so that they've got a lot of stuff that's just a little bit short, but their normal supply channels, they want it to be, you know, consistent length so that it fits in a case perfectly and looks
so
right on the shelves.
It might have had the regular size tips, but very short stalks on it, apparently, something like that. And as you know, if you go to the store, you always seem to find the asparagus standing upright in the water to try to keep it fresh, but it all seems to be the same length. And that's obviously what they're looking for, is the uniformity. But it doesn't matter when you end up breaking off the ends anyway, and you turn it into something that goes in the pot and have it as asparagus, or
right.
Put it in a recipe or something. So.
Yeah.
When the program got started with this mission to reduce food waste and in turn come up with a way to offer up fresh produce at obviously a better price, I'm sure, because it isn't perfect to begin with, how does a subscription service like this work? How do you in turn sign up people to become members of the Imperfect Produce family?
Yeah, so anybody interested, and you should be, should log on to our website, imperfectproduce.com. And you'll go on there. You'll let us know what type of produce you want. You know, whether you're really interested in vegetables or just fruit, or ideally you want both, because we've got everything. And then you can let us know whether you want organic produce, all organic, or conventional, or a mix. And then also how much produce you need. You know, we don't want to sell you more than you need. So you can if you're a smaller family, you would say that, and you would get a small box, which is about 7 to 9 pounds, which you could get weekly or biweekly, and ranging up to, you know, a big box would be about 25 pounds of produce.
Now, Nathan, since you are the director of quality control for the company, you get the chance to work probably closest with the farmers or the sources out there, I would imagine, where you can come up with a regular way you can contract out, get people involved to be involved in the service.
Yeah, well, we actually have a full-time supply team based out of our headquarters in San Francisco, a bunch of really talented people who have developed some great, you know, personal relationships with the growers across the country, even a little bit into Mexico. But what's really great for me is when we do get to partner with some of these local growers, you know, it's not every day that you get the farmer himself dropping off the produce to a distribution center like ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to meet a lot of really cool farmers over the past year that we've been operating in the Midwest, and a lot of great product coming out right here in Indiana. And we even work with some co-ops in Indiana and Michigan, so we can get down to working with farms as small as just a few acres. You know, it's not a, you know, anybody, like Sam said, who's had a garden before knows how easy it is to grow a lopsided tomato or apple or something. So we've got to get to know a lot of great farmers over the year.
Now, Sam, so you're working with the folks here in Northwest Indiana since you're out of the Chicago office. What's been the work like so far in trying to set up the distribution center that is going to open up next week in Griffith?
Well, we've been servicing Indianapolis for about 8 months now, driving right driving right by, and we've heard from a lot of folks in Indiana, hey, it's not all about Indianapolis here. There's a lot to the state that's not on that tip of the state, and so we're excited to launch here and start to service customers here, and then also out of our facility here, we're going to be able to service some of the South Chicago suburbs that we're currently servicing from our facility near O'Hare, but geographically it's going to be easier to come from here.
Well, I see if you're working out of the north suburbs right now, as you say you are working out around near O'Hare, it's going to be a lot more convenient, and would offer, I guess, customers, people who sign up for the subscription service in the south suburbs as well as Indiana, a chance to get the produce and the vegetables, the fruit that they want a lot faster, I would imagine, than having to wait several hours longer because it had to come down from the north side, so to speak. Yeah. Now, tell us about the organization that is being set up in Griffith, where it's located, and how people can find out more about Imperfect Produce and be able, if they're interested, sign up for the service.
Yeah, so we're launching. Our facility is going to be in Griffith, Indiana. Our first deliveries are going to be next week. We've already got a bunch of folks that have been signed up and on our waiting list for a while, knocking on our door. So, and the best way to find out if we're going to service your area is to log into our website. You'll be able to put in your zip code, and we'll tell you if we're servicing that area. And if we're not, let us know you're interested. There's a way to go on the wait list, and then we'll hopefully launch your area soon.
And you mentioned here that the fact that the operation is going to open up locally, based out of Griffith. You mentioned about the fact that it was convenient in a way because you would come by to Indianapolis to make treks down there to bring produce down the road, literally to the center of the state. And you decided that this was an opportunity to just veer off the highway and come into Northwest Indiana as well. Also, too, besides setting up the service, I understand too that Imperfect Produce is going to be doing some partnering with the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in all of our markets, we strive to work with some local nonprofits and organizations that align with our mission of fighting food waste and help get food into hungry hands. So out of our Chicago facility last year, just servicing Chicago, Milwaukee, and Indy, out of that facility, we were able to donate 400,000 pounds of produce that, again, fresh, totally healthy stuff, just stuff that we weren't able to sell to our customers. And we've been able to do that through food banks and other organizations. And in Northwest Indiana, launching this facility, we'll be working with the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana.
And obviously the company's had a great deal of success in working with food banks in other states and other regions to be able to pass along the produce, the vegetables and fruits as well, too, it looks like.
Yeah, I think the number nationally, you know, again, we just finished 2018. Obviously every business does their accounting, and for us, we also really care about how much food we're getting into the hands of food banks, and I believe the number is 1.5 million pounds for 2018.
Wow.
Which feels really good.
Now, once again, the website address, if people want to find out more, as well as to show you're interested in being a subscriber, is?
imperfectproduce.com. And also, when you log on there, you'll be able to plug in a promo code,
yes,
NWI50, which will give you 50% off your first box.
That's great. That's great. Well, it sounds like that you're off to a good start here. You found a not only expanding out of Indianapolis here in Indiana, you found a great market here. And I suppose this, if the demand is there over time, you're going to find other cities here in northern Indiana that they'll be close enough to Chicago that can kind of do a dual purpose in servicing them too, as well as Indianapolis.
Yeah, of course. We're looking forward to expanding further into Indiana, and a great way to, you know, help direct where we go is to sign up on our waiting list and tell us you're itching for some funny looking carrots, and we'll get there.
Well, also I mentioned this special promo code when we put up our podcast today of the program on lakeshorepublicradio.org. The information will be handy to look at there as well too. Sam Lacey and Nathan Sumner, both gentlemen working with Imperfect Produce, have come in. Imperfect Produce is a produce subscription service. It takes advantage of picking out the ugly produce, the ones that aren't perfect looking, but still very tasty and still very fresh, and be able to get them into consumers' hands instead of sending it off to the landfill, which in many cases that would have gone to, I'm sure, from maybe not from the supermarket standpoint, but from the farmer standpoint. It gives farmers in Northwest Indiana as well another venue to be able to get your produce off and get it off into the hands of the customers as well. Too. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today to talk about the service, about the business, and with the opening of the Northwest Indiana operations next week, I'm sure that you'll get many more notes on your website about people interested in be sure to be able to take on some ugly looking produce in the kitchen at home and cook it up into something great. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I would say that it's hard to remember how many times I've been a good neighbor or have had the benefit of a good neighbor. If I go all the way back to my childhood, probably the most unusual but the most prominent thing for me is that there was a woman across the street on our block who had debilitating rheumatoid arthritis. And so she was bedfast. So my mom would go over and help clean house for her. We might have lunch with her. We just visit. And then other times when I've lived in Indianapolis and had neighbors that have just been friendly, or they notice something amiss at your house, or take a package in from the rain. There are so many little ways that we end up being good neighbors to each other. And, you know, I think we often don't think about how the little things build up to create that relationship that you want with people you live around. It's not a responsibility or an obligation to any individual neighbor. It's sort of a common responsibility for your environment. It's why you don't empty ashtrays into parking lots, because somebody else is going to be there. You know, it's not your space to trash. Dump them out in your house if that's how you feel about it. Keep them at home. So I think there are real basic obligations that are certainly important. But some people don't even feel the need to follow those obligations, right? Trashing people's yards, yelling rude things at people. So that's a person who's not respecting their obligations to the community, I think, right? And then you get into the diversity issue. I mean, to me, that strikes right to it. The issue of acceptance, recognizing that people are different, but they're not less because they're different. You know, even economically, just because someone doesn't make as much money as you are doesn't mean that they're not smarter than you are. You know, if you don't recognize that, then you really are missing a lot about people. You don't have to love everybody, but you certainly, I think, should be polite to people when you see them on the street. I mean, that's one of the issues that we've had here with townies yelling racial slurs at students who may not be white Anglo-Saxon. And to me, that's a violation of whatever basic obligation you have to your community.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. You'll see some new signs on the busy Indiana Interstate Highway soon, and maybe hopefully fewer trucks that are parked on the shoulder of the highways as a result. The Indiana Department of Transportation just kicked off the local implementation of the regional Trucks Park Here program. It's a way to help truckers find the spots they need to be able to take a break from their over-the-road duties. We had a chance to talk with NDOT spokesman Scott Manning about the program.
You will, across 8 states in the Midwest region, and Indiana is one component of those. And the larger goal, of course, of the program is to make highway travel safer for motorists and passenger vehicles, and also for truckers themselves, by providing real-time information for truck drivers on the availability of safe, secure truck parking as they travel the interstate system here in Indiana and across the Midwest.
And I imagine probably a lot of this has to do with the fact that trucks are such an integral part of the entire transportation system, getting goods and services from one point to another, from intermodal links with railroads into individual stores or the cities and the like. So you have to think about the truckers and consider what they have to deal with on the highways, aside from just the general road congestion they have to deal with and the weather, of course. They have to find some places where they can make their legal stops, don't they?
Absolutely. Being able to find safe, secure locations for commercial truck drivers to rest is critically important for the safety of everyone who uses our highway system. And it's something that, as technology evolves, becomes that much more important, and it becomes increasingly important for truck drivers to have information to make informed decisions well in advance of stopping at the end of their shifts. Commercial truck drivers are required now by federal law to use electronic driver logs, so they are tracked to the minute down to the second, how long they've been driving and when their shift is required to end. So they don't have a lot of leeway or flexibility in driving an extra 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes to find a parking space. They need to know what the availability is, half hour up to an hour before they're ready to make the stop, so that they can time the end of their shift to reach a location where they do have safe, secure parking available.
And I imagine, too, a lot of this has to do with the driver fatigue, the problems that they face because they have to spend so many hours on the road, and then they have to take themselves off the road as required by the law.
Right. It is a requirement of federal law that these drivers drive a defined shift. And once that shift reaches the end, they are required to stop for a period of time to rest. And that is to ensure the safety of everyone using the highway system. And you mentioned driver fatigue. It is a serious concern from a safety standpoint. A fatigued driver can present just as much of a concern for public safety as an intoxicated driver. In Indiana, there have been about 1,400 reported crashes in the last 3 years where driver fatigue was noted as a factor in a crash involving in a truck involved crash. So it is a problem, and it's one that we hope to address and curb by, again, providing information to truck drivers well in advance of the end of their shift of where they can find parking that is that's safe, convenient, and readily available.
We're talking with Scott Manning. He's a spokesperson for NDOT based in Indianapolis. And about the Trucks Park Here program, we know that we're going to find this opportunity coming up here on not only on I-65 and I-69 and I-70 here in Indiana. Tell us how the breakout is going to be for the truckers and motorists that will be traveling through by the rest stops on I-65, in particular here in the northern part of the state.
Well, for motorists on I-65, the most visible component of the Trucks Park Here system will be our dynamic message signs that display the real-time information on parking availability. So as drivers use I-65, maybe they're traveling south from Lake County or traveling north from Indianapolis, they will, at periodic intervals along the route, notice dynamic message signs that display the distance to state rest areas along that route, and also a number that will update regularly on the number of signs available or number of spaces available.
Yeah.
So, for example, you may encounter a sign that says, nearest rest area 5 miles, next one 50 miles away, the next one say 90 miles further along in the route, and each one of those will have a number that displays the number of spaces in real time. Once parking is at a threshold, if you will, in very limited availability, it will advise the driver that there may be only a handful of spaces at a given location. So that, again, gives just an added piece of information to let a driver know that, perhaps the rest area closest to them is low on parking, but there's one maybe 30 to 40 miles further on the route that does have parking available. So that's the most visible component that all motorists will see at the truck parking locations themselves. There is some technology in the truck parking area, some sensors embedded in the pavement, and also some technology that communicates the data back and forth between the sites and our traffic management center that's in place at each of the rest areas. And then there's a significant online component to this system as well, that the information on truck parking availability will be online on NDOT's TrafficWise system. It'll be available on the Trucks Park Here webpage, which is kind of the central clearinghouse for information about the program across the eight-state region. There will also be several apps that are specifically targeted for use in the trucking industry that will also have the information. So it really, the data and how we share it and how the commercial trucking industry will make use of it is really a combination of on-the-road technology, but also digital web and web and smartphone technology also.
Now, Scott, have you gotten any feedback? Although we know it is very early, the program actually just officially got underway here not long ago. But any feedback, either digitally or on the phone or in person, from people that are involved in this to see how well the Trucks Park Here system is going to work?
Well, the system just went live January 4th, so we are less than a week in, and we're excited to hear the feedback and see how the system works for truckers, what they like about it, what they think could be improved, because ultimately we have a couple of goals long-term for the system. One is to refine it and make sure that it's providing that maximum value, but we also want to expand to some other locations, specific to Northwest Indiana. 65 certainly is a heavy route for truck volume, but so is I-94. So as we refine this system and look for opportunities to expand it, we look at I-94 as a perfect location to, as we build the system out, implement the technology on that route as well. So we are very interested in that feedback. It's very early. But I will say also the trucking industry has been very much involved and has been a partner at the table during the development. So they have really from day one helped to inform the states on what kind of information they need and how it's most beneficial to them to receive it. So we've gotten great collaboration through the development of this program, and we're really hopeful now that it's live and available to all truckers to get even more insights on how to make it better.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for the information, and the best to everybody at NDOT in working this program through, and I hope you do get the feedback and get to expand it like you'd like to. We certainly would like to see some expansion up here on the highways in northern Indiana as well, too. Appreciate you talking about it today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Scott Manning is spokesperson for NDOT in the Indianapolis headquarters, talking about the new Trucks Park Here system. It's a multi-state regional effort to try to make interstate travel safer, not only for motorists and small vehicle drivers, but also for truckers, too. It benefits truckers in helping them find a place to be able to get the rest that they need to take. We celebrate the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King here in Northwest Indiana. Coming up on January 23rd at Valparaiso University, the tradition continues with a 30th annual celebration. It's built around the theme of what everybody ought to know. And with us to talk about it, we have Byron Martin. He's the Director of Multicultural Programs at Valparaiso University. And with him is Associate Professor of History, Dr. Heath Carter. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Let's start first, of course, by reminding people why we seem to remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this particular date, this particular time of the month in January.
King was one of the most transformative figures of the 20th century, not just United States history, but really history on a global scale. For the last 30 years here at Valparaiso University, we have remembered and celebrated his life and legacy. Obviously, King, at the point when he was assassinated in 1968, was still urgently doing the work of justice. He was in Memphis at the end of his life fighting alongside sanitation workers, unionized sanitation workers, for better wages, better working conditions. Oftentimes, I think of the kind of elementary school version is that, way back when, 50 years ago, Martin Luther King solved the problems of civil rights and social justice. But in fact, King himself, at the end of his life, knew that there was so much work left to do. So partly here at Valpo, we remember him and celebrate him, but also remember that there is 50 years later so much work left to do.
Now, I know on the Valparaiso University campus, you not only focus in with the celebration and the convocation that goes with it with the speaker, which we want to find out about too, but also you spread it out to the entire community for activities and discussions that are focused around key issues. And a lot of the focus sessions give you a chance to talk more about what Dr. King had thought of and was trying to do, and how we could try to continue to fulfill the dreams that he set forth for us today. Let's talk now, if we may, and by remark, I know you can fill us in on that since you probably helped arrange the speaker to come in. Tell us what Dr. Eddie Glaude Jr. is going to talk about as this year's convocation speaker.
Yeah, definitely. We're excited to have Dr. Eddie Glaude Jr. from Princeton University coming to join us on campus. If anybody knows his work, he is definitely one of those that keys in on aspects of justice and how we need to be transforming ourselves to be more just in today's society. And so he's going to come in and speak on the theme, what everybody ought to know. And the goal of his talk is really to drive us into a better understanding of there are just some things in 2019 that we just can't plead ignorance on anymore. There's some things that we ought to know, and because we know these things, because we have access to these versions of mass injustices that are happening in our communities and in our nation as a whole, we need to do something about it. And so his talk is going to help spur us on to do the work right here in our local communities that's joining works that are happening on a national front as well.
I know we've had opportunities in the past here to hear from Dr. Glaude when he's appeared on programs like Democracy Now!, which we carry here, in fact, right after Regionally Speaking, here on Lakeshore Public Radio. We have the radio version of the program that is on, and then some other programs as well, too, where you have a chance to hear what he has to say. It'll be interesting to see how he follows through with these comments to talk about the overall mission that, that Dr. King had set and unfortunately was interrupted by his death.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Chris, for those of your listeners who aren't as familiar with Glaude, I just want to stress what Byron said, that he really is one of the nation's leading experts on African-American history and life and sort of the long durée of civil rights, social justice work in this nation. He's not just a kind of decorated scholar who is very well regarded within the academy, but also a social and cultural commentator who frequently appears not just on Democracy Now!, but a whole host of news and television programs, and is really, I mean, I think it's just a real privilege to have him here on our campus on MLK Day, and I hope we'll get a good crowd from around the region.
Now, how did you gentlemen happen to have a chance to be able to get him to come to Valparaiso University? He's, I'm sure, a well sought out person, very much in demand for speaking.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and we're excited because not just Dr. Glaude, but we have a host of focus session speakers, preliminary speakers that will be happening that morning that will really serve as a strong scaffolding to Dr. Glaude. We have Dr. Simon Mary Aoki, that is a systematic theologian from the University of Portland. We have Dr. Dwight Hopkins, who is a professor of theology from the University of Chicago Divinity School. We have Ms. Carrie Gray, who works with the U.S. Business Leadership Network out in Washington, D.C., and does a lot of work on accessibility. And then we have Ms. Deneen Powell, who is the Executive Director of Groundwork in Milwaukee. And so we have a really strong lineup that we're excited about that's really going to come and hit on several topics here for us that speak from wealth and inequality to faith and justice to equity and access to even environmental access and environmental justice and inclusion. We're also excited that this year we're actually bringing our first ever K-8 opportunity for the community. So oftentimes people say, what am I supposed to do with my kids? Sometimes the conversations are way over their heads. Mm-hmm. So we developed this year a nice opportunity for kindergarten through eighth grade students to come to our campus as well and have an opportunity to kind of get a dose of what does justice mean, but at their level.
I know, too, that a lot of this information we've just talked about here, of course, is on the Valparaiso University website. But also, too, in particular, there's separate information, too, on the MLK for Kids track that you've just talked about here to tell parents and educators more about this so they can link all this together, too. Tell us, if you will, gentlemen, about the Valparaiso University Martin Luther King Jr. Award, the importance of it. And mention it, of course, this time of year especially.
The MLK Jr. Award that we do here is really working to honor and to really commemorate somebody that's doing that work, the work of Dr. King, here in our campus community. It goes to celebrate the work that is happening now to spur people on to continue to do that work. It's not just somebody that does a ton of service hours, but it's somebody that really lives out the mission of Dr. King in our community. And it's an opportunity for us to not only give them their roses while they can smell them, mm-hmm. but it's an opportunity for them to be lifted up as an example for everybody to come and join in the work of justice in our community.
As we said, more information about rather detailed schedule of events for the 30th annual Martin Luther King Jr. celebration on the Valparaiso University campus is on the website, valpo.edu/MLK. The specific information, too, also found about MLK for Kids that we've just talked about here, about being able to bring young people into the conversation to get them to learn more about the work, celebrating the life and the mission of Dr. King himself. It's all there on the website as well, too. And if you want to find out more about the program and find out more about the very special speaker coming in for the 30th annual convocation presentation. You'll find it on the website there too. Byron Martin and Heath Carter, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. And we hope this all goes well. You get a great turnout and people find out more about this. So that come January 21st, they'll be coming over to Valparaiso University and you'll probably have some traffic problems and maybe some parking problems too. Something that you probably like to celebrate in a way too, I would imagine. We've been talking with Byron Martin. He's the Director of Multicultural Programs at Valparaiso University, along with Dr. Heath Carter. He's an Associate Professor of History at Valparaiso University. They're the co-chairs for the MLK Day Celebration 2019, coming up on January 21st. You can find breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches just about anywhere you go in Indiana. So Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier set out to find how pork tenderloins became so popular. She begins with a visit to a small community cafe south of Indianapolis.
It's lunchtime at Come and Get It in Martinsville. The small restaurant sits on the corner of the town's courthouse square, and it's full of regulars. But it's Melissa Bowers' first time here. She drove over from Bloomington because she has a question she wants us to answer.
My question was, what foods are Indiana originals? And the reason why I asked that question is because I'm originally from Maine. And when I moved out here, I noticed all the foods that I was used to were created a little bit differently out here.
She'd heard of other Indiana favorites like sugar cream pie and persimmon pudding. But somehow the sandwich, Hoosiers consider synonymous with the state, never came up.
People are so used to tenderloins being out there that they don't even realize this food is, it's part of Indian history.
I set out to learn how the breaded pork tenderloin became so popular in Indiana, and everyone kept pointing me to the same place, Nick's Kitchen in Huntington, Indiana. Lindsay Skeen is the Marketing and Communications Director for the Indiana Foodways Alliance. She says many people point to Nick's as the birthplace of the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich.
There was a German immigrant in 1908 that had a local food cart that he started selling his version of a new recipe similar to the Wiener Schnitzel, but is now known as the pork tenderloin sandwich.
That man was Nick Feinstein, a Huntington entrepreneur who opened Nick's Kitchen. His picture still graces the walls of the more than 100-year-old restaurant, which Jean Ann Bailey now owns. She says Feinstein sold his interest in the business back in the 20s. And while she's made a few tweaks, she says the tenderloin is still based on his original recipe.
The tenderloin itself, we slice them here, and then we run them through a cuber, which is, it tenderizes the meat, and then we marinate them. And that is the key right there. We marinate them in a buttermilk and egg and flour mixture for more than a day.
Enthusiasm for these colossal sandwiches extends far beyond Huntington. You can find tenderloins just about everywhere you go in Indiana.
It's a butterfly pork loin fillet that we have cut by a local butcher, and then we bread them and fry them here.
They're what keeps the loyal lunch crowd coming back to the Sunoco station near I-74 in Crawfordsville. Owner Trish Schwabe says they don't serve your typical gas station food. The meat comes from a local butcher, and it's hand-breaded, then fried. She says they sell a couple hundred tenderloins a week.
I want it to have that initial crunch when they bite into it and the juiciness of it and just a burst of flavor in their mouth. And I want them to go, wow, did I just get this at a gas station?
Even the state's only Indonesian restaurant in Greensburg offers a tenderloin. Several different kinds, in fact. Owner Mayasari Effendi says it all started when a friend asked her to compete in the annual Tenderloin Throwdown.
And I said, what's a tenderloin?
She learned quickly and ended up placing in half the categories. The next year, she took home an award in all but one. It seems every place has its own take on the Hoosier Classic. Some people like theirs pounded thin, others thick and juicy. But even after finding the answer to Bauer's question, she wasn't sure how she preferred her pork. That's because, despite living in the state for 13 years, she's never tried a tenderloin. We had to change that. After all, Come and Get It is on Indiana's Tenderloin Trail.
That's really good.
And through that bite, she gained a better understanding of why, to Hoosiers, this is so much more than a sandwich. It's part of our history.
That's really good.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Have you ever noticed how prices for airfare don't always seem fair? Plane tickets and how they get priced next time on Marketplace.
Tune in at 5:30 for Marketplace here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Mindy with Mindy Abair and the Bone Shakers.
The Bone Shakers.
The famous and not so famous musical talents every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Midwest Beat with Tom Lounges. It's an hour of music, stories, and fun. Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on the Lakeshore.
There's been something actually in the Indiana statutes for years about what constitutes bias, but there really hasn't been a lot that maybe are giving prosecutors a bit more of tools to be able to offer any greater sanction on any offenders that may be accused of bias. But there is a bill that has been filed that will come up in the upcoming General Assembly session from our next guest and a co-sponsor as well that will take the hate crime measure one step further. And we have with us Senator Mike Bohacek from Michiana Shores. And thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity.
You and your colleague, Senator Ron Elting from Lafayette, have proposed what is right now listed as Senate Bill 12, which will go into great detail on some additions that will be made to Indiana criminal law for prosecutors and for judges to take a look at when it comes time to deal with a particular case. If you will, first tell us what you feel are the most important additions that the measure that you and your colleague are offering up for lawmakers to consider this session.
Sure. Certainly, what we did is, and I know, unfortunately, this is always called hate crimes, and it's really not. This is true bias crimes legislation. And as you look at the legislation, it makes sure that everybody, regardless of whatever characteristics they have, are protected. But it happens at time of sentencing. So as opposed to creating a new group of laws, this gives our judges the opportunity, and I trust the subject matter experts, which is our elected judiciary, to, at time of sentencing, use a sentencing aggravator. So let me give you an example. So if you were convicted of battery, and that's a level 6 felony, there's an advisory prison sentence. The judges can go on the lesser side via mitigators or on the more aggressive side versus aggravators. This bias crimes legislation at time of sentencing provides our judiciary the ability, if they see fit, to be able to aggravate the sentence. What's nice about this, or, I mean, none of this is nice, but the flexible part of this is that even in the case of a plea agreement, so if a level 5 felony is pled down to a 6, the judges can still utilize this aggravator at time of sentencing. So we're hoping it's going to be a deterrent, But if not, it allows the judiciary to sentence as they see best fit.
A bit more flexibility than perhaps what the current statutes call for, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are there any points in particular, and I know that the additions that are put into the law, which is stated in the bill, talk about specific situations or incidents that perhaps, if you want to call them that, that might be considered more as bias indicators here. What are these points that maybe are not in the measure now that will perhaps make this measure more attractive when the lawmakers have to take a look at it when session starts?
Certainly, yeah. When I had co-authored a bill last year, the scope was very, very narrow. There was I think there was about eight different categories of bias. But Senator Alton and myself realized that bias is bigger than that. And in listening to debate during committee and other conversations, we realized that we needed to have maybe a little bit a bigger scope. But then also make sure that as times change, the legislation can also grow with our community, which the last qualifier protects bias in any other identifiable group, and I think you'll see that in the bill. Mm-hmm. So as times change, this would allow the bill to be dynamic and not have to continue to be readdressed over and over again. And once again, gives our judiciary, who are our elected judges, to utilize this the statute as they see fit. So I think it's a real, probably the biggest part of this, or the biggest attribute of the bill, is the flexibility that we have now that previous legislation attempts did not have.
Does the measure that you and Senator Alding are proposing not necessarily focus more on, but have bring up maybe more prominently the issue of concerns about bias and discrimination against gays and lesbians and transgender and bisexual people?
Gender identity, mm-hmm. is in the bill, whether it's perceived or actual. Sexual identity is there, whether it's perceived or actual. We also, have many other specifically protected classes, and then also some broad language that would also address situations that potentially were missed. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very very broad reaching piece of legislation.
More so than what the current statute has, apparently, right?
Well, the current statute is a Supreme Court opinion. So some say that our judges can already do this. There's some debate about that as far as the ease of being able to utilize bias as an aggravator. And Senator Alton and myself believe that the best way to let our judiciary handle this is with specific statutorial language, and thus Senate Bill 12.
Were there any examples or incidents or other information that's come forth here in the meantime that you and Senator Alting have taken a look at to bring up the issue of I guess bias, certainly in this case here, some would call them hate crimes, that maybe is what prompted you, besides wanting to beef up and make this bill a bit more comprehensive than last time?
We get asked that question all the time. What specifically triggered you to author this legislation? Senator Alton and I, have the same conversation. We just feel that it's time. It's been time for many, many years. We can talk about the young man that was accosted in Chicago just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. We can talk about synagogue's vandalism. We can talk about any number of issues. We can talk about the young man in North Central Indiana who was victimized due to bias. When you're authoring legislation, you hope that it's not due to single issues, but more importantly, it's an overreaching effort to resolve something that's just not addressed and it's not right. Mm-hmm.
I know there's also one other question that's come up here and has been asked before, and you probably had to answer before, too, about what kind of economic impact, if there is any, that if this bill passes and it becomes law as the session goes on, would benefit Indiana perhaps more so, since Indiana, and it's been published before and mentioned before about the fact that Indiana is only one of five states that does have a quote-unquote hate crimes bill.
Right. And we've talked about this too. Many of the chambers of commerce support this. Our public universities support this. Many in our business community support this. And you're absolutely right. Part of this is also an economic bill. You know, as companies look to relocate to this to a state, they look for specific protections, and they look for legislative things that are going to benefit their business. Now, Indiana does an exceptional job of attracting new businesses, but on the social side, I think we've kind of missed a little bit. And I think it's probably cost us some higher-end tech opportunities because we just, you know, we just don't have these protections. So, and you're absolutely right, we need to look at this a little bit more beyond the criminal side and also onto the economic development side to be able to attract, you know, great talent from other states and also great opportunities. So you're absolutely correct. It's a bigger issue than just the criminal side.
Now, let me ask the question. I know you're optimistic about this. You have to be optimistic about the bills that you either introduce on your own or you introduce with your colleagues in the Indiana Senate. Do you think that the way this measure has been written, and maybe you've gotten some indication from your colleagues also ahead of time, that this measure may have some chance of passage this time?
During the session, especially this early on, because the session doesn't start until January, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic, but you know, we're working to educate our colleagues and on both sides of the aisle, because there's resistance on the Democrat side too. They, you know, some folks think this doesn't go far enough, and trying to get some consensus. Now, both myself and Senator Alteen, you know, we're cautiously optimistic. We're working very hard to gain consensus and to address the issues that our colleagues may have on both sides of the aisle, to see if we can get something that's workable, that will pass quickly. We've been working on this for 3 years. So, you know, the saying at the State House is great legislation typically takes 3 sessions, bad legislation takes 1. And I think after 3+ years of vetting this, I think we have a good piece of legislation.
Well, Senator Bohachek, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and see what your colleagues on the floor of the Senate and over in the House, because they'll have to take a look at it, too, if it gets out of the Senate before it goes on, if it's passed by both houses to go on to the governor for his review. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and as always, we hope that this next session goes well for you and your colleagues at the State House.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Indiana State Senator Mike Bohachek. He's a Republican from Michiana Shores, and he and his colleague Senator Ron Alting from Lafayette are producing a measure which deals with the question of bias, making some changes that perhaps lawmakers and judges will best be able to use when they take up these cases when they come before them. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, we'll find out what passenger rail supporters want out of Hoosier lawmakers this session and why it seems to be more difficult to recycle these days. Get answers to those questions and more on tomorrow's program.